Nearly every American gets interested in presidential elections, it seems. Sometimes we stick around and pay attention to what comes after the elections, too. And then there are some people who take a very long view of presidential elections and how they can shape the life and future of the country. William F. Buckley took a very long view, and to some degree he had to. He was conservative when conservatism was not yet cool in America, but he helped make it so for many people, including people who became president. Ronald Reagan is just one example in a new book called A Man and His Presidents, The Political Odyssey of William F. Buckley, Jr. It's the work of Alvin S. Felsenburgh, who served in two presidential administrations himself and was the principal spokesperson for the entity most of us called the 9/11 Commission. Alvin is the author of several previous books, including one on presidential ratings called The Leaders We Deserved and A Few We Didn't. Alvin Felsenburgh, thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you today.
Well, it certainly seems natural to move from books about presidents to books about people who advised presidents. Does William F. Buckley easily top that list?
Yes, he did, particularly with the Reagan administration. Most newspaper columnists do not become part of a president's inner circle, even if they're very supportive of his program. Buckley was a great exception to that. Christopher Buckley once said that he thought that his father, William F., was probably the closest male friend Reagan ever made, at least in his political days. He used to reminisce Reagan with his Hollywood buddies, but didn't really open up to them. He talked about common experiences and things they had had. With the case of Buckley, the two clicked in spite of a rather large age difference. There was a 15-year gap. They were not the same generation. They had different formative memories, different social backgrounds, but there was something about their personalities and there's something about their ideas that clicked. They always talked policy. From the time they met in 1961, their wives became friends. Two men bonded greatly. They went on vacations together, the four of them. They exchanged messages about how to bring up children, what their aspirations for their children might have been at any given point. Politics, every time there was a public relations brouhaha that Ronald and Nancy Reagan found themselves in, Buckley went into overdrive. And he advised them behind the scenes as he was writing columns openly. He sent hundreds of advisors to work on Reagan's campaign and in their administration. And I would say one of his indirect legacies is some of the great writers he gave pointed Ronald Reagan to. Buckley was a great admirer of language, and he grew up saying, well, one of the reasons we're losing so many arguments is because all the great intellectuals of our generation are on the other side. In many ways, admire Adlai Stevenson and John Kennedy for bringing in the Galbraiths and the Schlesingers and the Sorensons and all the people that made the new frontier. The new frontier, he said, why aren't we ever doing that? So we had a radar out, and when Reagan was elected, he sent some fascinating people Reagan's way. We can talk about some of them. One wrote the great Tear Down This Wall speech. Another one wrote the Evil Empire speech and the Ashiva of History speech, where Reagan condemned the Soviet Union. These are lines we remember. Many of them were Reagan's, but the context in which they appeared and the speech themselves and the cadences, it was all indirectly William F. Buckley, Jr. and his friends.
Who were some of the people who wrote those works for Reagan?
The Tear Down This Wall speech is from a gentleman now residing in Northern California, Peter Robinson. And the Evil Empire speech was Tony Dolan, who's written speeches for many, many presidents. He was a Buckley protege, a generation or two behind Buckley at Yale. But Buckley very much admired his writing and worked very hard to get him into the Reagan campaign and finally succeeded.
So, Alvin Felsenburgh, this is not just a view from afar. I understand you corresponded with Buckley starting a very long time ago.
Yes, I never worked for him, and I won't say I was an intimate, but I could say over the years, over the decades, we had what I'd call an active acquaintanceship. I wrote him when I was a teenager, asking to meet him. He kind of came into my consciousness when he ran for mayor of New York. This was the most memorable campaign that I remember growing up, where a man is having a press conference running for mayor of the city of New York and asked what he would do if he became mayor. And he won the election, and he said he would demand a recount. I thought it was the funniest thing I'd ever heard. And when I started hearing some of the policy pronouncements, I said, this fellow is really something. He also was extremely witty and extremely eloquent, which you certainly didn't see in city politics then. You rarely saw in national politics then. John Kennedy was the only other person like that I remember. Anyway, I began following him, and as I got to college, I began to read him very carefully. And I started writing him notes, asking to meet him. I used to joke that when other kids in my town were lining up to hear the Beatles perform, I was standing outside Montclair High School in the rain waiting to see William F. Buckley talk in the gym. So I was that kind of a teenager. I finally did get into seeing him when I was 20, 1969. Had a glorious afternoon with him, and after that, we met every now and then over the years, a couple of telephone calls, later on emails, and of course a lot of letters, and I cherish all of those.
Yeah, beyond the points of conservatism and his success at advancing them, we have just about a minute to a break, by the way, you say he was fun.
Oh, it was great fun. People are expecting conservatives to come out with great wit. I'll hold the other one for the end of the break. But yes, he had one-liners. He was young. Most conservatives were supposed to be old. He was a man of action. He was a sailor, an aviator. He'd show up to some campuses on a motor scooter. This is not exactly the National Association of Manufacturers, which is what we thought about. We thought about conservatives.
All right, we'll come back and talk more about A Man and His Presidents, The Political Odyssey of William F. Buckley, Jr., with its author, Alvin S. Felsenberg, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Back on the Exchange with the author and your phone calls and emails in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking to Alvin Felsenberg, who served in two presidential administrations, has written books about presidents, and was the principal spokesperson for the 9/11 Commission several years ago. He has written a book about William F. Buckley and his contacts in and on the White House. A Man and His Presidents, The Political Odyssey of William F. Buckley, Jr. is the book. You can join us on the Exchange, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So let's come back to the fun thing. You had another story you wanted to tell us about Buckley.
I held this for after the break. Imagine I was 15 years old sitting in my mother's living room hearing a debate. Here's a conservative candidate running for mayor of the most liberal city in the world, New York City. And he's asked, how would you differentiate among your two opponents? And he said, well, Mr. Lindsay, Congressman John Lindsay, was standing about 6'4". So I would say he was a very tall liberal. His Democratic opponent, Abe Beame, stands 5'1" with lifts in his shoes. So I would call him a very short liberal. So the differences between them are more biological than ideological. Imagine when his 5 minutes comes and this is what he's saying. So in 1967, when Firing Line, the show that grew out of the mayoral campaign, because he may have lost the election, but all the producers in the country were watching these debates because the newspapers were on strike during Buckley's run. And so the electronic media filled the void. Well, he had a contract to go on television starting this show, which would be moved to PBS, called Firing Line. Well, after 2 years of the show, 3 years of it, Time decided to put Buckley on its cover. And the caption was not William F. Buckley, a conservative. The caption was on the cover, William F. Buckley, Jr., : conservatism can be fun. So he gave conservatism a happy face, which they would also see to some degree in Ronald Reagan. They didn't see that from previous conservatives. They saw angry people, seeing that they were complaining. They had a lot of grievances. This man enjoyed every minute of life in the show.
It really did. You know, it's interesting, too. I want to come back to the Ronald Reagan connection. Ronald Reagan and William F. Buckley are together on the front of the dust jacket of the book. You mentioned they met in 1951. Reagan was a Humphrey Union Democrat at that point.
Yes. Yes. Reagan was anti-communist always, but he was a New Dealer from 1932 on, and he was the president of the Screen Actors Guild. Some of your listeners may find occasionally on eBay a couple of marvelous photographs of Ronald Reagan standing next to Harry Truman and Lauren Bacall and Humphrey Bogart, 1948, campaigning for Harry Truman's reelection. He went all across the country. I don't know how many states he had crisscrossed. He bonded with Hubert Humphrey because Hubert Humphrey, of course, was the anti-communist firebrand young mayor of Minneapolis. And, of course, a lot of people refer to Hubert Humphrey as the happy warrior. So if you wanted to have a happy conservative and a happy liberal, even though Reagan and Humphrey went different directions, whenever Humphrey was campaigning in the state of California, he would stay at the governor's mansion. Imagine that, leaving the governor's mansion, going off to a Democratic rally somewhere in the state of California. But, you know, Ronnie said, you know, friends can stay in the guest room, period.
Wow, that's an interesting point. To Buckley himself and the way he would offer advice to leaders, this was something that developed early in life. I was just kind of fractured by the fact that he wrote a letter to George V of England.
Yes, you imagine that. The only argument in the family, the mother said he was seven at the time, and the father said he was six. Imagine that. But he writes a letter to the king saying, well, this is the early 30s. Isn't it time that you paid us back the debt you incurred in the Great War? And that was the beginning of it. And, of course, Franklin Roosevelt was the family's, what can I say, arch enemy in a way. A devil incarnate. Everything Roosevelt was for, they were against. And Buckley joins the America First at a very early part in his life. He's a 15-year-old card-carrying member of America First Association. Going to hear Charles Lindbergh rally against America getting involved in another war. And his parents, this is a side of Buckley's marketing. His parents decide, well, you're about to start prep school in the fall. As a token of our affection and pride in you, we're going to buy you a sailboat. They buy him his first sailboat. And he was quite a competitive sailor with a lot of ribbons and trophies. And so he decides to call the boat Sweet Isolation. So every time he wins a ribbon or a trophy or an award, his father's politics are somehow covered in the story. So I think it's another great story about him. Early age on, at Yale, he becomes the chairman of the Yale Daily News. Now, he wrote, obviously, a college newspaper. You're covering college politics. Occasionally, he would talk about national politics, one of the great editorials that I cite. After the 1948 election, Harry Truman decides the country needs a tax hike. Buckley's lead was, the worst calamity that ever befell the West was when the Harry Truman's haberdashery failed. He went into politics to bankrupt the rest of us. And you don't see that too many college newspapers even now.
No. We're talking to Alvin Felsenberg about his book about William F. Buckley and his influence on the White House. The book is called A Man and His Presidents. Now, Buckley started the National Review, his own magazine, during the Eisenhower years. Eisenhower was a Republican, which in today's world means conservative, but he was very critical of Ike's policies. Why?
Right. Well, first of all, Ike thought he was a conservative. Ike believed in balanced budgets. He believed in going slow and not rocking the boat and reassuring the country that everything was fine. The president has time to play golf several times during the week, so you have nothing to worry about. Buckley was rather annoyed. He said, you know, we spent 20 years railing against the welfare state, railing against more entitlements, Franklin Roosevelt and his New Deal. Ike doesn't seem to be in any hurry to repeal any of them. And what's wrong here? Second, Eisenhower and his now Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, talked about rolling back the Soviet encroachments on Eastern Europe, and they're still there. So he decided to set up a magazine, try to move the party somewhat to the right. This would be a place where all conservatives could gather to see their opinions affirmed and also to see what other conservatives were saying at the time. In fairness, there's a lot about Ike that was not so obvious at the time. Buckley, I think you have a rather impatient young man who tended to take Ike at face value. So when Ike would say that he's offering to have the Soviets inspect American missile sites in exchange for our expecting theirs, he called it the open skies in Geneva, Ike knew, number one, that we had, because of our surveillance system that was greatest in the world at that time, and we had 10-to-1 superiority of the Soviet Union. He also had a very intricate system of what we call it spying, there's no other word to say. He knew the Soviets were going to turn him down, and he thought that there was a good PR advantage in having the non-aligned nations of the world see that the United States was making every effort, and it was the communists saying no. But Buckley tended to take Ike at his face value, so he thought he was naive, and in some cases even stupid. But he changed his view later on. Not of Ike, but of the policy that we're talking about.
So William F. Buckley's version of conservatism seems to be largely about who sets policy, elected people who can be voted out versus professional staff who stay potentially a lot longer. Is that a fair characterization?
Yes, very, very much. He was a great critic of bureaucracies. That's right. And he felt that bureaucracies do not have their own interests. They're supposed to serve the public. And he would say, well, we've changed administration after administration, and no matter what policies were advocated in the campaign, the implementers rarely changed, and the outcomes rarely changed. So that's right. He wanted the bureaucracy more accountable to the political guardians who would come in every 4 years or so. He's very upset with that, and particularly during the McCarthy era. He didn't feel that the bureaucracy was communist-dominated, but he felt that because of the rules that the bureaucrats used to promote themselves and advance themselves, they lacked the stomach, shall we say, for ferreting out severe security risks. And there were security risks. McCarthy made a lot of mistakes, but there also were many, many people whose security clearances were lifted because of some compromising things they had done in earlier parts of their lives when we were allegedly allied with the Soviet Union, while the Soviet Union was spying on the United States by infiltration. And the most famous cases of this was the Aldrich case, the very high-ranking State Department official exposed to be a Stalinist agent by a fellow named Whitaker Chambers, who becomes one of Buckley's great mentors. So, yes, you're absolutely correct that bureaucracies do not have interests. They're supposed to serve us, and we should have a check on them somehow. Yes.
Well, and I wonder, too, about Buckley's version of conservatism and how conservatism turned a bit sharper, even within his lifetime. I mean, he seemed adept at putting down people's arguments, but he could still be friends with the people who made them.
Yes. Well, Buckley personified civility at the height of his popularity and celebrity status. He was packing in about 70 college appearances a year. And he knew that, you know, youth likes to rebel. The early socialists who fueled the think tanks that gave birth to the New Deal were all fueled by young idealists who then became Roosevelt's brain trust and such as that. He said, why don't I appeal to the young generation now to overthrow Orthodox encrusted liberalism? And I will go to the 70 colleges, and I won't get a majority of the kids, but I'll get a couple on each campus. I don't need a majority. I need a handful of people to move the world. And these became some of the people that he sent Ronald Reagan's way, but he was always shopping for people like that. He also believed that coalitions exist through addition. When he founded National Review, he said, well, his colleague Frank Meyer used the word fusionism for it. Like, we have a number of us who are feuding about various things. We have libertarians. We have traditionalists who believe in Edmund Burke and institutions and changes are made very, very slowly over time. We have religious conservatives even then. And they were all united in one thing, a tremendous hatred of the USSR, and a tremendous fear that if the USSR expanded its interests, certainly libertarians would not be welcome. It was an atheist ideology, so certainly those who believed in God would not be welcome. Traditionalists wouldn't be welcome when Lenin was trying to smash those very traditions in Lenin Doctrine. But they held together. And in his time, neoconservatives joined that coalition. They were all former Democrats. There were talks on the USSR, but they accepted the New Deal and part of the Great Society. They would change this with time. And then the religious conservatives. So that's true. But you mentioned today's stridency. The idea of personal attacks was not in his vocabulary. I told you how he put down his liberal and conservative opponents in 1965 when he ran for mayor. He didn't attack Lindsay personally. He just pointed out he was tall. He was liberal, right? And, you know, if that's an attack, well, go ahead, John. You know, I'll buy you a beer and get over it. I mean, that was not the kind of attacks we hear now. And we unfortunately saw, not only in the last campaign, but we see in campaigns for governor, for mayor, for senator. And he had no use for that.
Alvin Felsenberg.
He was capable of, go ahead, sir.
I was just going to give a reintroduction to remind people we're talking to Alvin Felsenberg about his book, A Man and His Presidents, The Political Odyssey of William F. Buckley, Jr., about Buckley's influence on occupants of the White House over the years. 800-838-3760. If you'd like to join the conversation, email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Daniel in Grants Pass. Thanks for waiting. Welcome to The Exchange.
Yeah, hi, Jeffrey. Alvin, I wanted to find out to what degree was Buckley the source of Ronald Reagan's statement that government doesn't solve problems, but government is the problem. Was Buckley a pretty big influence there?
That was a line in Ronald Reagan's inaugural speech in 1980, that government is not the solution to a problem, it is the problem. I would say less so in that. The philosophy was the same. But the words were Reagan and Reagan's writers. Now, whether Reagan's writers shared the draft with Bill, I don't know. But he certainly felt the same way. But I would make one caution in that. A lot of people dropped the first part of that. Reagan didn't say all problems. Reagan said our current problem. He was talking about inflation. And, of course, government did cause inflation. And it took a great deal of courage on the part of Ronald Reagan and Paul Volcker to be willing to take a very steep recession, if you want, so we would come out better on the other side. He didn't say for all government created all of our problems. It did create inflation. I'm just saying the first class of that sentence is often dropped, but I don't know a direct lineage to Bill Buckley on that one. No.
All right. Let's talk about other occupants of the White House, or at least attempts to occupy the White House. Bill Buckley was no fan of Eisenhower. There was no endorsement from the National Review of Richard Nixon in 1960. But then he's got 1964 and a true conservative running in Barry Goldwater. How close were they or not?
They were close. Goldwater was a more difficult student than Reagan, in a way. Reagan said to anyone who would listen that William Buckley was the man most responsible for the Reagan presidency and the man who did more than any other to ease and guide Reagan's transition from liberal, democratic, conservative, Republican. Goldwater was a conservative by instinct. He grew up in Arizona before it was even a state. The idea of frontier, not just frontier justice, but also libertarianism, was very, very much part of Goldwater's background environmentally. I mean, Buckley got to his conservatism by reading, by thinking, by the influence of his parents. Goldwater came to it because he grew up with it. If you didn't like your neighbor and it was really getting difficult, you could move to another town, right? There are very few regulations, right? If you settle things, well, maybe they sell it in a saloon, but not normally, and it was not his preferred way. But live and let live was Goldwater from the get-go, even till his last day. He was a very tough cactus libertarian, is what I call Goldwater.
He got a lot of support from the John Birch Society, and I wonder what Buckley thought of it.
Well, this became a problem, and the John Birch Society, when it started, agreed with most conservatives on most issues. They wanted the Soviet Union curbed. They didn't want the federal government regulating every aspect of human life and economic life. They wanted what I said, you know, if you didn't like the town, move somewhere else. Don't overregulate your neighbor and all of that. Well, a fellow named Robert Welch was the creator of the John Birch Society, and he wrote a book called The Politician. And he tried to keep the book under wraps. I don't know how you keep a book under wraps, but he circulated them to his friends, and he had numbered editions. And in this, he said that we were losing diplomatically, politically, militarily to the USSR, not because we had weak leaders, which is what Buckley thought we had, but because we were controlled by Russia. Eisenhower was a member of the International Communist Conspiracy. Well, many of the members did not even know Robert Welch was doing this, but nevertheless, Buckley decided we have to rat them out because we are being judged by the most extreme parts of this coalition.
Okay, I have to pick that up on the other side of a break. The book is called A Man and His Presidents. Alvin Felsenberg, our guest, back on the Jefferson Exchange in 1 minute. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking to Alvin Felsenberg, who's written a couple of books about presidents, including one just recently about William F. Buckley and his influence on occupants of the White House. The book is called appropriately A Man and His Presidents, The Political Odyssey of William F. Buckley, Jr. You can join our conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So Buckley essentially blew the whistle on the John Birch Society and the 64 election?
After the election, remember, Goldwater was the nominee, and the John Birch Society became an issue in the campaign against Goldwater. Goldwater would never come out and denounce the entire society. As I mentioned, many of his friends were in it. Some of them may have known Welch personally. Some may not have believed that Ike was a communist, but Goldwater wouldn't do that. By the time Goldwater's off the scene now, Buckley's running for mayor, and he sees a real chance. First of all, he did write a series of pieces against Welch and against Welch's conspiracy theories, but he couldn't ever get Goldwater completely on the hook with him about the organization. But now that Goldwater's off the national stage, he'll come back to the Senate later. Bill is now running his own campaign, and he decides that, yes, we're going to have to take them on severely. And he writes an issue of National Review, the entire thing, is against Birchers and conspiracy theorists and how it's poisoning the well in which all conservatives and Republicans are drinking. And so he gets Ronald Reagan. He doesn't just stand alone. He gets Ronald Reagan, who is going to run for governor of California the next year. He gets George Herbert Walker Bush, who had run for Senate in Texas and is planning to run for the House seat in 66. John Tower, who's a Republican senator from Texas, and a number of leading intellectuals that sign on with him. The entire issue was on Birchism and on conspiracy theorists and trying to save the movement from its most extreme element. And that's what gets him tremendous attention. The Washington Post writes an editorial, having disagreed with everything on the pages of National Review since its founding. Washington Post writes an editorial saying Buckley is finally getting his movement to be taken seriously by riding roughshod over its extreme elements. Now they really have to engage the rest of his philosophy. The easy thing for liberals is just to attack Birchers. The hard thing is to say, why is Buckley's tax plan better or worse than ours? Well, that requires some work. And you get the same kind of thing from James Reston, who is the most read liberal columnist. He had a piece of column in the New York Times, I think close to 30 years. He calls this Buckley's finest hour. So Buckley's getting praise in some odd quarters. And that kind of praise gets him even more attention. So now he's being interviewed by Life magazine about John Birch Society. Life magazine never interviewed him about anything National Review wrote other than this before. And he's now using that platform to sell the rest of his program.
So did the run for mayor of New York in was it 65 or 67? I forget.
Yes.
65.
Was that partly to raise his profile and take advantage of the publicity he already had to raise the profile of conservatism?
Well, he wanted to use his persona and the power of television, which I talked about earlier, to show that conservatives could compete in a urban environment where they weren't seen to have many, many things to offer. He did not expect that there would be a newspaper strike and national television would be covering this municipal election. Never expected that. But he had been, I mentioned the Yale Daily News, he had been the chairman of that. I didn't mention also 4 years in at Yale, chairman of the Yale championship debating team. They took on every university in the world. They clobbered Oxford every year, won the North American Cup every year he was at Yale. And so he's shown in the debates. He knew how to draw attention to himself when he wasn't even speaking. But other people were speaking through his expressions, through his mannerisms, through his posture. The audience was watching him. They were enthralled by it. And, of course, when he got up to speak, I mean, complete sentences with a complete agenda for anything they thought about, as opposed to sound bites written by political consultants who were trying to get their candidate to avoid making mistakes. Buckley would tell you what he saw. Couldn't understand why he couldn't get a cab in the rain. He said, well, what about allowing anyone with a car and a good license and no prison record to rent spaces out to people who wanted to pay for a ride? Well, you know it is Uber. Right,
right, yeah.
Right. He was worried about rent control, wondering why young people, leaving college to get a job in New York, have 5 or 6 roommates. They're back in the dorm. Why is there a housing shortage in New York? Why can't people pay for them? Well, because we have rent control. Rent control encourages people to stay in their apartments, whether they want them or need them. They can rent them out at their own dime, if you want, and earn money out of this. Landlords have an incentive not to improve their buildings because they're terrified that the assessments will go up. So everybody's playing the shell game. We get rid of rent control, we could probably deal with the New York housing shortage. Why don't we have bicycle paths around traffic? Well, we have them now. Bloomberg and Koch put them in at different periods. So these are the things he's offering. He's also saying we have disparities in sentencing and our narcotic laws that discriminate against African Americans. And surprise, surprise, the first conservative ever to say that affirmative action is not always unwarranted. He said we singled out majority population, singled out African Americans as a group, and we should do something to compensate them for things that we did. He took on the labor union for discriminatory hiring practices, not allowing greater numbers of Black Americans into their apprenticeship programs for skilled labor. He became a bête noire of George Meade, then the head of the AFL-CIO. Very unconventional positions for conservatives, but now he's got a national audience for the ideas. And, of course, that led to the show, which had a bigger audience. And the impression that many of your listeners have of Bill Buckley was probably formed from firing line more than by anything else.
Yeah,
but the mayoralty was a real transition to that.
I love what he said, that if he won the election, he would demand a recount.
Yeah, isn't that amazing?
He had some fun. So we haven't talked about Richard Nixon, though, and whether he had much of a relationship. I know he had a relationship with Henry Kissinger, Buckley did, but not so much with Nixon himself, it sounds like.
Well, Buckley was one of the people who brought Kissinger to Nixon's attention during the transition, which is an interesting sidebar of history. You already pointed out that National Review did not endorse Nixon in 1960. That's because they disliked his role as playing Ike's apprentice. Well, that was the vice president's job, which is not necessarily Nixon's detriment, but Buckley didn't like that, and they didn't back him in 60. Well, what happens in 1968? Well, he decides, first of all the presidential candidates come according, because Buckley's got what? He's got a national audience, and he's got readers. His syndicated column ran in 500 newspapers, and he ran 2 or 3 times a week. So when Buckley endorsed, if he chose to, he had some power behind that. So the 3 candidates are all coming according. One is governor of New York, Nelson Rockefeller. Dr. Thought was too liberal for the party, mainstream. Second one was Reagan. And we talked about Reagan already, but Reagan was the only governor a year. These were the days when people expected presidential candidates to have some experience. And before Obama changed the game, said a two-year senator can have run for president. Now we have people running for president without any experience. He thought the Democrats would really go after Reagan for not having enough experience and policy concerns. And we should hold Ronnie for another day. That's a direct line from Bill. Then we had Nixon. And his view of Nixon was guarded. We just talked about that. But he thought Nixon would be a little flexible, some things he thought about, cared about. And I guess his attitude toward Nixon was what Mrs. Thatcher said about Gorbachev. Maybe not one of ours, but somebody I can do business with. So he does Nixon a couple of favors. Endorses Nixon, which shores up Nixon's shaky conservative credentials. Against Reagan in an odd way. And secondly, takes the opportunity to destroy George Wallace's claim to be a plausible alternative for conservatives. He argues that Wallace is the kind of person that embraces states' rights, but not because he cares about states' rights. States' rights to him is a fig leaf for denying benefits to African Americans. He says, look at every form of spending. He's for it. 60% of Alabama's budget is coming from the federal government. Buckley would say, I don't want the programs. We hope Mr. Nixon cuts back. Well, he gets very disappointed. Nixon does not cut back. But if we're going to have programs, I don't want them denied a certain group of people because of their race. Destroys George Wallace on this. Has him on firing line. Writes Nancy Reagan after the show that Wallace is the most dangerous man in America, and I think I put him away. He then writes a piece for Look magazine saying why people who endorse the things Buckley endorses would be better served voting for Nixon and not Wallace. So he helped Nixon in two areas. But, of course, when you vote for somebody on the grounds that they're the lesser evil, if you will, or they're someone you can do business with, you do get those times where you can't do business. He objects to Nixon's wage and price control, some of his spending and tax policies, and, of course, the rocketing inflation, which the wage and price controls were supposed to alleviate, but they don't. Would have hoped Nixon had the courage that Reagan had to take the heat for a recession to bleed inflation out. But Nixon had a different view. Then, of course, Watergate comes. You know the rest. He becomes first conservative columnist, asked for Nixon to resign a year before Watergate. And he's not happy that Nixon goes out the way he goes out. The line was, he had a chance to go out with dignity early. He didn't take it. Now he's going to be tossed out, Buckley says, with the chicken thieves. Imagine that.
So there
was a very bad break with Mr. Nixon at the end.
Okay, about 3 minutes left in the show. Here's Tony and Talent. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Alvin Felsenberg, the author of A Man and His Presidents.
Good morning. Very interesting show. I think the reason why Buckley was such a superb sort of Renaissance man was not just his company that he kept with politicians, and I know that was his big interest, but he had a very broad spectrum of friends. He was friends with Galbraith and Friedman, very close friends with both of them. He used to ski with David Niven, and he enjoyed lunches frequently with people like Alistair Cook. And you see his firing line, and he was the match to such intellectual giants of the day as Muggeridge and Enoch Powell. This is the man who was not just a politician. He enjoyed life, and he was a very, very intellectual, almost the nearest thing American can be to an aristocrat.
It's very true, Tony. I thank you for that. Bill spent a lot of care on developing friendships. Friendship was very important to him. Friendship transcended ideology. He befriended people he obviously liked, of course, but people he could learn things from, people who would challenge his intellect. And you mentioned this, very, very close with Galbraith. Niven. Could have mentioned, to some degree, Norman Mailer. Late in life, Arthur Schlesinger wrote to his diary, "I must be getting old because I can't even get upset with Bill Buckley anymore." Right? Imagine that. He never gave up. He never gave up trying to make a friend where he could. And he did. He did permeate that little crusty side of Schlesinger. He finally did get to him. Took a long time, 50 years. When Arthur died, Bill said, "I always regretted we didn't become friends." Well, he didn't know what Schlesinger was writing. He was working, was getting through. He had irresistible charm. And it was very hard to dislike Bill Buckley. Whatever he may have said, it was very hard to dislike a man with that personality. George Will said that he had a smile that could light up an auditorium. I can't tell you how many times I've seen it myself. And in the debate situations, such as the one I just gave you, he would say things that even would make John Lindsay laugh.
Mm-hmm.
And Lindsay was not known for being very witty. So, I mean, he got to you. And the gentleman, Tony, was absolutely correct. Alistair Cook saw a lot of himself in William Buckley. Alistair Cook was a British journalist who fell in love with America in the late 40s, and he was covering it. And he was the host of Masterpiece Theater many, many years. And when Brideshead Revisited had its American debut, it was Alistair Cook suggested Bill Buckley for the announcer. How was that? Tony mentioned about an American aristocrat.
Wow, that
anyway, he's the closest we came.
Indeed. The book is called The Man and His Presidents, The Political Odyssey of William F. Buckley, Jr. Alvin S. Felsenberg wrote it and joined us today. Thank you, Alvin.